our next case, which is Jacobs versus U.S. Trust. Mr. Stanton.
Morning, Your Honor. Steve Stanton on behalf of Nick Jakich, Jay Dunlop, the owners of Gulf 255 Incorporated. In March 2009, the trustee abandoned corporate records back to its original owners of the corporation, and in those records we discovered three pivotal items that were never heard by the court,
This is preposterous, this litigation. It's never going to end, right? It goes on forever.
I reviewed a lot of documents to prepare for this hearing, Your Honor. It was an enormous task.
So what is your conception of the difference between just ordinary fraud as a basis for reopening a lawsuit and fraud on the court?
The essential ingredients of a fraud on the court are the involvement of an officer of the court and the production of, usually involves some kind of evidence introduced by that officer, or that officer was involved in either by silence or by an affirmative act that simply was perhaps even a fabrication. In this case, that's exactly what happened.
So who is the officer of the court?
The officer of the court that we've based the fraud on the court theory on is Michael Kilty. He was the petitioning creditor. He claimed to be
not an officer of the court.
Well, he testified. He was only one of two petitioning creditors to testify at the hearing on the involuntary petition.
How does a creditor become an officer of the court?
He was an attorney, Your Honor, and he ingratiated himself with the other attorneys and personnel involved with the court system. And basically, the entire involuntary case revolved around his testimony and the documents that he brought to court. In addition to that, in open court, he testified that he was an officer of the court in the course of his testimony.
Call lawyers officers of the court, but we couldn't mean that to say that any time a lawyer engaged in misconduct in litigation, that was a fraud on the court. Could we say that?
Well,
you're going awfully far.
Not every time, Your Honor. No. In this instance, though, it goes beyond that. He petitioned for the appointment of a trustee individually in his own name. He also was the originator of the documents that were brought to court to establish the basis for the involuntary petition to begin with. And that's where the nexus of the fraud came from, was the documents introduced into court, and several times the parties objected to foundation, which were overruled by the bankruptcy court because of the preconceived notion that he was a former president and owner of the corporation, which in fact ended up to be a total fallacy.
But your clients were there, and they argued this point, did they not? And the judge said, well, I don't need to take evidence.
If we back up a little bit further, 1 month before the involuntary was filed, he seized control of the business operations of the golf course, and he took corporate money, put it into a private account, opened with a false Social Security number, doctored to look like a corporate number, and then he used that money to hire an attorney to represent the debtor in the bankruptcy proceedings. At the beginning, he convinced this attorney, a Mr. Don Sampson, that he in fact had authority as the president of the corporation to hire bankruptcy counsel to commence a voluntary bankruptcy petition. It came out in court that neither of the owners of the corporation really favored filing a voluntary petition, and that this was a complete fabrication as well.
Well, what's the role of the lender in this whole problem? Obviously, this company was in trouble financially, and we all know that the bank holds all the cards, or at least 99 of 100. They weren't going to give your clients.
The bankruptcy was filed on the eve of a foreclosure proceeding, and there's nothing in the record to show the efforts my client was able to make at that time to stop the foreclosure, although I know of some because I was involved later and found out. But one thing that was certain is that during the one-month period when Kilty operated the business, unilaterally seized control, he canceled the retainer check for the foreclosure attorney hired to defend the state court proceedings, and he signed a waiver form to discharge that attorney on the eve of a deadline that would have preserved their rights in the foreclosure and extended the time for them to battle the foreclosure in state court. Now, there's also some documentation issues, but to back up and answer your original question, The bank wanted the property sold to get paid now. The bank always wants paid now. And there was a buyer found by Kilty prior to the filing of the petition. I guess there's a dispute of whether they were offering $5.5 million or $5 million, but in any event, it was more than sufficient to pay off the $2.2 million owed to the bank that had the mortgage. This was a case where, in reality, the bankruptcy was more to protect the principals of the debtor than its non-insider creditors. In fact, the trustee's final report indicated that there was quite a bit of money, in fact, over $1 million left over to be distributed to the principals of the corporation for insider claims, even though the equity holders got nothing. And so the entire case was premised on a faulty, based on a faulty premise that there was some exigency to sell this property when there was a clear equity cushion of millions of dollars. It ended up being a proceeding to resolve differences between the insiders, but it was presented to the court as an emergency basis to preserve the rights of the creditors. It was all a manufactured emergency from day one.
How much did Jakich actually come up with?
Did he get from the proceedings, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm.
I believe he got $650,000 along with his ex-wife, Hofmeister,
She got the same amount?
I believe so. And a gentleman named Hanchek got a large sum. And there was a small distribution at the end of the case where there was some surplus money remaining. I believe it was in the $8,000 range right at the end of the case when there was another distribution. The importance of Mr. Kilty's hiring of counsel for the debtor cannot be underestimated. It tainted the entire proceedings from day one. One of four petitioning creditors was a non-insider, and that was a gentleman from TNT named Terry Schrader. And the court found his testimony to be credible. The problem is that nothing in the court's order finding the involuntary bankruptcy as being appropriate even made a determination regarding its general ability to pay its debts. The only evidence offered at the trial involved the debts of the four petitioning creditors. Two of them were insiders, two of them were non-insiders, but one of the two, Supreme Turk's claim, was based upon a completely fallacious invoice that was created by, I believe, Supreme Turf, although the record doesn't show because they never testified. This document was introduced by Mr. Kilty, but he brought a version that was created in November, a month after the petition had been filed, and the original invoice surfaced 2 years later in the records held by the trustee. And the original invoice showed the debt wasn't even due at the time of the petition. It clearly stated that they had until October 15th to pay the debt, whereas Mr. Kilty testified in court that it was a COD transaction, and, well, he had control of the money, but somehow he just got confused and didn't have the money when the time came to pay it. And it was clearly a manufactured testimony. And all the objections to Mr. Kilty's testimony were overruled by the court based on the assumption that he was a former president and owner of the debtor. And the court later found in the documents filed by the trustee support the notion that he was never a former officer of the debtor and he never was an owner. And so the entire...
Do you think it was had fraud rendered upon it?
Yeah, Your Honor, what was that?
What did the court, you say the court later discovered, did the court think there was some kind of fraud on the court? Or what's the source of this? There may have been internal fraud.
None of this came out until much later. I got involved in 2008, over a year after the involuntary petition had been granted. The appeals were dismissed as moot because the sale was run through on an expedited basis, and the district court believed there was no controversy remaining for appeal. So the actual decision of the involuntary determination was never decided on the merits. In the meantime, the debtor's principals continued to investigate, but without the resources available to them as the owners of the corporation.
You know what's so strange about it? So what is it you want to do with the golf club?
We would like to remand first to show the fraud on the court. Second stage would be the remedies. One of them could involve undoing the sale, although to do that we would have to show that the purchaser participated in
so
a scheme.
What is the basis for thinking the purchaser was part of a conspiracy?
Well, our efforts to discover evidence on this have been hampered by the refusal of the bankruptcy court to allow us to conduct discovery. However, and you've got to realize that the only way I got this evidence in the record was by attaching them to my brief for reconsideration because the court would not allow any introduction of evidence or discovery.
Litigation really undermines bankruptcy law. Because someone, bought the golf club years ago and now you want to take it away from that person.
there's some indication that they were willing to pay $5.5 million before the petition was filed.
Go back 100 years trying to get people's property on the grounds that there had been fraud against the court. People wouldn't have any security in their property rights, this kind of litigation.
We may not prevail on the issue of undoing the sale, Your Honor. That's one of many remedies we would like to pursue. But
one of many remedies? What are some of the other remedies you want to pursue?
Well, at a minimum, the judgments by the bankruptcy court at this point are insulating the former principals of the corporation and Mr. Kilty from any kind of civil lawsuit liability, because the precedent created by the bankruptcy decisions, the trustee had a mediation at which all of the claims of these people were litigated. By that time, the corporation had long lost its ability to have any input whatsoever in the bankruptcy process. It didn't have an attorney since March of 2008, and the principals tried to hire their own counsel. They tried to even participate pro se, but there was never a chance for them to offer their evidence, conduct discovery, or have the judge hear anything about the fraud on the court, because the essential pieces of the puzzle that made it all come together and make sense, which is always the case in a fraud on the court, weren't discovered until after March of 2009, when we had access to further documents.
Well, the trustee knew about all this.
Well, Mr. Eggman is an honorable man, and I don't believe he would intentionally ignore any evidence, Your Honor. I believe this is a case where Mr. Kilty took advantage of a system in which he knew that money would control and that a trustee's job, in essence, is to distribute that money fairly. And I think Mr. Eggman did a great job once the determination of insolvency was made and the sale was completed. He's an excellent trustee, but I don't believe he thought it was within the scope of his duty to look into an issue that redounded mostly to the benefit of the insiders. And that might be true in most cases, but in this case it was an insider bankruptcy because there was plenty of equity in the property for the insiders to be paid. And so it's my view that the trustee missed something here. It wasn't intentional. I believe he was misled, just like Mr. Sampson, the trustee, the attorney that was hired for the debtor, and the court, and Ms. Grandy, the petitioning creditor's attorney. I believe Mr. Kilty misled all of these people, and this is the evidence we discovered in the records that were abandoned by the trustee in March of 2009. Could he have discovered it by looking at the records? Yes. Your Honor.
Why is this a bankruptcy case? Why don't you just sue Kilty?
Well, Kilty would be able to avail himself of the orders entered by the bankruptcy court to show collateral estoppel.
You say you can't sue Kilty without getting the bankruptcy undone? Is that what you're saying?
I believe he would use it as a defense. I can give you an example. I did file a lawsuit on behalf of the corporation against Hoffmeister after the bankruptcy was concluded, and I received
the
ex-wife, Your Honor, yes. And I received a telephone call from Mr. Eggman advising me that I was acting improperly because he was the trustee for the bankruptcy estate and I should not be filing a lawsuit against Ms. Hoffmeister. And I haven't made any efforts to serve that lawsuit since, but I did advise Mr. Eggman that there was no state pending appeal, and if the case was actually closed, then the stock would go back to the owners and we would have the right to prosecute Ms. Hoffmeister. But even that was opposed by the trustee and lies in wait at this very moment based upon the pendency of this appeal.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Stanton.
Thank you,
Mr. Eggman.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Rob Eggman. I'm the trustee. I also lead counsel for the trustee in this case. As Mr. Stanton said, we've been in this now for about 4.5 years. In fact, we're just down the street here from your previous case, I noticed when I was listening to oral arguments, so we're right in the same area right there. The case in the last 4.5 years has been touched by 5 bankruptcy judges: Judge Myers, Judge Fines, Judge Altenberger, Judge Pepper, Judge Shermer. Two U.S. District Court judges, Judge Herndon and Judge Murphy. The attorney representing the petitioning creditors, Laura Grandy, was then one of the 3 bankruptcy trustees out of these East St. Louis Division of the Southern District of Illinois. Now, of course, she's a judge. Don Sampson, one of the other trustees, represented the debtor. I was the 3rd trustee, therefore I got the case by default. So you've had everybody in the Southern District of Illinois really looking at this case, whether they be a trustee, a bankruptcy judge, or a federal district court judge.
Has there been any complaint to the U.S. trustee that there's fraudulent activity going on?
Yes, 2.
two complaints?
Correct.
What did the U.S. trustee decide to do?
They determined that after their investigation that there was none. The golf course was sold in March of 2007, Mr. Stanton is correct, and we received sufficient funds from the sale of the golf course to pay off the secured debt to the Bank of Edwardsville. In addition, we had sufficient funds to what we thought at the time to pay creditors in full, based upon the bankruptcy schedules that I put together as trustee and filed with the court. What were not part of the bankruptcy schedules, because there was no evidence to support the debt at the time, were the debts to the insiders, the monies loaned by Ms. Hoffmeister, Mr. Jakic, and Mr. Honcheck. And when those claims were actually filed by their respective lawyers, that put this as an insolvent bankruptcy estate. That's what brought about the mediation with Judge Shermer, which took place over a one-day period. And Judge Shermer is a Chief U.S. Bankruptcy Judge for the Eastern District of Missouri. Present at the mediation were, in fact, myself and my counsel at the time, Charles Riske. Mr. Jakic and his counsel appeared, and as well as Mr. Dunlop appearing pro se. The mediation was not in any way, shape, or form an arbitration or a trial. It was an attempt to resolve all the claims in Golf 255. There was no stipulation. There was no argument as to who the, quote, true owners were. What happened was, out of the mediation and the settlement that was approved by the court, all Mr. Dunlop asked for was that he be declared an owner of the golf course. Mr. Jakic wanted certain claims. Ms. Hoffmeister wanted certain claims. Mr. Honcheck wanted certain claims. And Mr. Kilty, for example, as well. Those claims were mediated. Those claims were decided upon. And those claims were settled. So it's not as though there was ever a determination made by any court as to, quote, who the true owners of Golf 255 Inc. were. Through mediation, Mr. Dunlop became the owner. There's no part of the record that suggests that the invoices submitted by, for example, TNT or Supreme Turf were in any way, shape, or form fraudulent. None whatsoever. There's no evidence. But what the evidence is clear is that these parties did appear in bankruptcy court at every hearing. Whether they appeared as representatives of the debtor or representatives of themselves as creditors and equity holders. And what's also clear from the record below is that Don Sampson was employed as counsel for Golf 255 Inc. And what's clear from the record is that when he appeared on behalf of Golf 255 Inc. in the bankruptcy court, he was there with Mr. Jakic and Mr. Dunlop. He never put on the stand Mr. Kilty as his representative of the alleged debtor. It was always Mr. Jakic and Mr. Dunlop who was his representatives. Mr. Sampson's fees were allowed without objection by the bankruptcy court. Ms. Grandy's fees were allowed without objection by the bankruptcy court. None of these fraud allegations were raised at this time, nor were the fraud allegations were raised in connection with the involuntary petition in bankruptcy, which is a one-day trial, or the hearing on the motion for the sale, which was, again, a one-day trial. No fraud allegations whatsoever. They made legal arguments as to why they should not be an involuntary. They made legal arguments as to why the sale of the golf course should not go forward, none of which included fraud upon the court, fraud upon any party, or collusion of any party. The Chapter 11 plan of liquidation gave me as the trustee the right to object to the claim of creditors, but it also gave other parties the rights to object should I not object. It's standard in a plan of liquidation. Trustee gets the first bite. Other interested parties get the second bite. I filed numerous objections to claims. Many of those claim objections were granted. Some were settled. Some were withdrawn. No objections to claims were filed by these parties. Mr. Jakic was represented by counsel throughout the whole time. Mr. Dunlop at various times was represented by counsel. Not one claim objection was filed to these alleged fraudulent claims. Under 11 U.S.C. Section 350A, the court has the discretion to close a bankruptcy case when the court determines that the case has been fully administered and the court's discharged the trustee. The court made that determination that I fully administered this bankruptcy case. I paid all claims in full other than the subordinated claims. And those did include the claims that the court asked about momentarily or a moment ago about the claims to Mr. Honcheck, Mr. Jakic, and Ms. Hoffmeister. These claims were general unsecured claims, not subordinated. Those three parties do each have some subordinated unsecured claims that will not be paid in this bankruptcy estate due to the additional cost of administration.
What do you think is behind these two individuals' 5-year challenge to this? I mean, what?
Well, I think there's two things. One, they simply can't take no for an answer. Two, they want the golf course back. and which I think is a virtual impossibility at the present time. I sold it to a public park district, the Collinsville Area Recreational District. Bonds were sold to fund the purchase of this golf course. And there were exigent circumstances to make that, to sell that golf course as quickly as we did. We were going to lose our buyer. They had bonds outstanding that if they didn't close by the golf season in 2007, we had no buyer. They couldn't fund those bonds. So there were exigent circumstances found by the bankruptcy court. In addition, what was found by the bankruptcy court is we not only sold that golf course for fair market value, we sold it for more than fair market value. We produced expert witness testimony as to what it was worth as a golf course, and Mr. Dunlop's argument that it was worth far more as a subdivision. We put expert witness on during the motion to sell the golf course as to what it would be worth as a subdivision, which was very little because it's in that same kind of bottoms area, and it floods. So no basements for folks. So bottom line is we got far in excess of fair market value. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Need some landfill, right?
No landfill. And I don't know about the birds and the butterflies in that area either, Your Honor. I'm certain there are many. The bottom line is the court was correct in closing this case. We've administered about as much that can be administered in this particular case, so the court was right. When you turn to fraud upon the court, I think the court's correct. You've got a couple different kinds of frauds here. You can have fraud against a particular litigant, and you've got fraud upon the court. And that's a much higher standard. They have to prove, in fact, they have even alleged that there was some sort of collusive effort between all of these bankruptcy judges, or one was bribed, or I, as a trustee, manufactured some evidence. Mr. Kilty was acting on behalf of himself as a creditor. He was not appearing in that court as an officer of the court. The officer of the court representing the petitioning creditors was Judge Grandy. Well, I'm sorry, Trustee Grandy at the time, Judge Grandy now. It's force of habit. I apologize. So when you, the fraud on the court is distinguished from ordinary fraud because it involves more than just the injury to the person, but the injury to the court themselves. And we don't have an injury to the court itself. In fact, I think this case has worked out exactly how it should work out. You had a bunch of individuals fighting amongst themselves. You had a very valuable asset, a golf course worth potentially $5 million. You had a foreclosure sale that was going to take place, I believe, the 13th or 14th of October of 2006. And had that involuntary petition in bankruptcy not been filed, that golf course would have been sold and most likely probably purchased by the bank for the amount of the debt. The unsecured creditors, of which there proved to be in excess of $2.5 million in unsecured claims, would have gotten zero, not to mention the fact that the subordinated claims and the equity would get nothing. So I think that I don't think there was any fraud on the court. I don't think there was any fraud in connection with the involuntary petition in bankruptcy at all. But I do think one thing is certain, that we reached the right result in this case. The golf course was sold to a public entity. It's operating. They're employing people. We got a far in excess price of fair market value. We paid non-insider general unsecured claims in full. This is one of the rare occasions where bankruptcy works the way it should work. Finally, we have a motion for attorney's fees under Rule 38 of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure. We're exhausted litigating with Mr. Jakich and Mr. Dunlop. We've litigated everywhere with them. We've seen all of these different judges, and they won't take no for an answer. We've run out of money in the bankruptcy estate at this point in time. This appeal, I think, is frivolous. There's nothing more to do here in this case. And I believe that there is a basis to assert attorney's fees or assess attorney's fees under Rule 38 and under McNamara, this Court's decision. So unless you have any further questions.
I just had one, and that's just the, was it a going concern at your golf course at the time of the attempted foreclosure?
It was indeed, Your Honor. It was the involuntary bankruptcy was filed at the tail end of the golf season.
It had members and all that stuff and a golf
It was
club.
Not a private club. It did not have any, well, I take that they had a couple people who were so-called preferred status, but it had no real membership. It was a public club.
Pay to play and all that stuff.
Right. It was a pay to play, and I did operate the trustee during the winter, or I did operate as a trustee of the golf course during the winter months, which may not seem like a lot, but we had to buy seed and have employees out there getting the golf course ready for the spring season.
Okay, thank you very much,
thank
Mr.
you,
Mr. Eggman.
Thank you.
Mr. Stanton, do you have anything further?
Just one focus, Your Honor. The trustee tends to focus on the events that transpired after all the fraud occurred, after the determination of insolvency, after an expedited sale of the golf course that took place within a month of the termination of insolvency, after the appeals were mooted by the sale of the golf course, none of these issues were ever litigated in front of the court.
Is there any new evidence that has come to light since the bankruptcy proceeding?
Yes, Your Honor. There are three primary...
What's your best new evidence?
Docket number 634-9 is the original invoice prepared by Supreme Turf, one of the four petition creditors that did not testify, that Mr. Kilty introduced. He introduced...
So there's some invoice dated when?
It was the original invoice, I believe, was dated September 13th of 2006.
Okay, and this invoice surfaced when? When did you discover it?
In the documents that the trustee abandoned back to the owners in March of 2009. The document offered in evidence was created in November of 2006 by Supreme Turf, and it changed the terms. There was an affidavit also that went along with that that had a term inserted that wasn't in the original affidavit, and both the manufactured invoice and the affidavit...
What was this September 13th, 2006 invoice for?
It was for the purchase of seed for the golf course.
For the what?
For the golf course, a purchase of seed and fertilizer. And then it became a basis for one of the petitioning creditors' claims.
Okay, so invoice for purchase of seed and fertilizer for the golf course... And how does this show fraud?
Mr. Kilty testified that it was a COD transaction that was past due at the time of the involuntary, and the original invoice showed, in fact, that they had until October 15th to pay the invoice.
So what difference does that make?
Well, it bears on two issues. There were only four petitioning creditors, one of them being Supreme Turf, and at the time the petition was filed, the debt to Supreme Turf was not even due. Now, the four petitioning creditors were...
Supreme Turf was submitting a claim that was bogus? Is that what you're saying?
They were owed money, but it wasn't due yet.
Okay,
Under 303H,
So they were trying to get paid, and it was premature?
How does this show fraud?
I mean, Supreme Turf is part of the fraud, or what?
That's the fraud. To make it look premature, Mr. Kilty testified...
Is a party to a fraud?
Pardon?
Supreme Turf is a party to this fraud?
They created two contradictory invoices that helped support Mr. Kilty's false testimony at the hearing on the involuntary.
And who owned that?
Pardon me?
Who was in charge?
A gentleman named David Shields. There's also an affidavit from Mr. Shields because he refused to testify, and it looks like the date on the affidavit was also altered to make it look like the debt was past due.
So he's part of the scheme, too.
Well, the evidence that we found would indicate that, but when we tried to take his 2004 deposition in November of 2009, the trustee objected, and the court overruled basically denied our right to take discovery based on the trustee's objection. I believe the trustee wrote the opinion.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Stanton and Mr. Eggman. We'll move on to our next...